Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the weekly comics netcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka, alongside Jason Poliev. Every week, we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. I was going to say more books than last week, but actually, we're on at the same number. We're at 6 books this week as well of what we shared, so...
Interesting.
We can try to do the same thing as last week and do a speed show, and then just hedge it by saying we're actually going to do a 2-hour show and end up right at the hour length like we try to normally go for.
Yeah.
I say screw it. Let's just say we're going to go for an hour because that's about what we do anyways, so.
Yep.
Clear the next 60 minutes in your schedule, sit down, and let us fill your ear holes with wonderful comic talk goodness.
Yes. All right, we'll go ahead and get started with the one that started it all as far as superhero comics are concerned. Action Comics.
Yep. This one is, not to get too much into a lot of story stuff for it, but it's kind of an arc swing. It's in between two. In the last issue, we saw the death of Clark Kent, which was a rather shocking revelation, and talking about the new stuff as well with Perez and Morrison kind of having their issues writing between Superman and Action Comics.
Yeah.
For a big twist like this to come out, I'm sure Perez was sitting on his end going, what the fuck?
Well, Perez hasn't been writing the Superman comic for the past 5 issues.
For a bit, yeah.
But certainly, if Morrison had this planned this far in advance, which something tells me he probably did, then again, this is also the type of thing that we know is going to get reversed.
Yeah. Well, it kind of has to at this point because Perez has already written, as far as we know, we're going to go back and research it, but has written Clark Kent into Superman, which occurred 5 years later.
We know he's been written into it because Clark Kent is reporting for Perry. He's happy to have his job now at the Daily Planet.
Right.
And not at the other magazines.
Something Star,
yeah,
I think.
Star. And, you know, and Lois has got her job as the new media and television producer for the television side.
Which, come to think of it, she specifically does in fact call him Clark
when
the other, like, executive sleazebag guy.
Yeah, part of it is the fact that Clark keeps showing up missing whenever she needs him to do anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a whole, yeah, so we know Clark and Lois come back, you know, and.
You kind of.
There's a big event happening in here. I'm going to go ahead and kill that spoiler.
Well, yeah, I kind of already shat the bed on that one, so you might as well go ahead and wipe with the sheets while you're at it.
Lois gets hit by a speeding fire engine, and it knocks her shoes off just like Ray Brower.
God damn it.
I told you I was going to put that in there. So for those of you who know who Ray Brower is, wonderful, and if you don't... it's in a movie. The movie stars Will Wheaton and River Phoenix, so that should give you a chance to find it.
You can find it on Wikipedia, I'm sure.
Yeah. So there's definitely some stuff in here that we're not going to call it a retcon. We're going to presume that it's already been planned how they're going to be getting out of this mess. In fact,
we'll be damned if we can figure out how.
Well, part of it is, you know, they've already started this because they got Batman appearing in this issue and Superman going, hey, look, I need your help bringing back my other identity. I screwed up and killed it. I need some help with this.
What's interesting is he doesn't say that specifically he wants to bring back Clark Kent. He's just saying, here's the situation. I think I might have messed up on this. What do you got for me? And he really only takes it that far. And Batman just says, all right, you know, I hear you. Hey, I got some stuff going on. Leave your problem with me. I'll fix it up for you.
Yeah, it certainly is leaning in that method of, I shouldn't have killed off my Clark identity, fix it.
Yeah,
you know, he does say, you know, Bruce, you're always the smartest person in the room.
Which is surprising, he takes it as a, thank you, I think, as opposed to, yeah, you're right, I am. Which feels like that would be more in the Batman.
There's also
wheelhouse.
Like a connotation of, you know, you're not always the smartest person, how can you always think that you are? Connotation to that. It could be taken as a backhanded insult. So, but the other part with this is I'm kind of questioning where in the Morrison timeline this falls, because there's periods where he's wearing the t-shirt. There's periods where he's in the actual Superman costume, which he gets from the armor that we're told in the first arc. So once he's got the armor, which will change clothes for him, why is
which
he ever wearing the t-shirt and jeans?
Right.
Maybe he's chosen to continue to wear that look periodically.
But maybe it's a PR thing. Like when he's doing the more humanitarian type of stuff, he wants to look a little bit younger.
Maybe that's what it is. He's trying to show he's a man of the people when he's helping rebuild.
His armor could be more of like a official uniform type of thing. Like if he's going to do.
But when he first shows up to fight the menace, he's actually still in the t-shirt.
Yeah.
So does this actually, are there flashback sequences in that first arc that we're given where he's remembering getting his apartment as Clark in Hobbs Bay?
Right.
And this is taking place, the t-shirt and jean scenes are taking place at that period of time.
Yeah.
And then they're flashing forward to when he's to the main story of that arc where he's captured by Luthor and then goes to fight Brainiac in the Bottle City and rescue the Bottle City of Metropolis.
Right.
Finds Kandor, gets the costume there.
Which the only times that we see him in the Collector's satellite space station ship, whatever it is, he's in the armor. Yes. The only time I think we really see him in the t-shirt in this is right in the very beginning.
Yeah, it certainly opens up. And it doesn't really go back to it. So it makes me wonder, you know, is the opening of this just...
Him remembering better times?
Was it the first appearance of a series of enemies that come back later in this book? Yeah, that's also possible.
You know, that makes more sense than anything else, I think. I hadn't thought of it that way. That the beginning, because the beginning, it ends just with him in the t-shirt talking about smelling a fire over somewhere and then zipping off to go do whatever. So it's very possible that could have been set previously.
Well,
that was the memory that was triggered by him doing his now fire department stuff, which is his new alter ego.
Yeah, his new alter ego is as a fire department. So it makes sense. At least they're leading you to believe that he went from the rescue from
directly to that the fire. Yeah. Which could, I mean, it could just be bad writing. Not giving a good indication of a time translation between the two other than a page turn.
Yeah. There's certainly no indication of, you know, this was 5 years ago, this is now.
Right.
So why, you know, why was he wearing the one costume? Yeah.
Unless the costume itself was supposed to be the indicator. Which, if that's the case,
it's still
poorly done.
It's a poor job. Now, you see him and he's going off and rescuing people as a firefighter, which I think is a pretty cool,
smart
side job for Superman to have as an alter ego, but it's not really much of an alter ego because he's doing what he normally does. And why doesn't he just do it in costume? So, and I think, part of this deals with him,
I would say he gets medical benefits, but that's not really going to make much of a difference for him.
Part of this also, maybe he starts to feel that, because he's doing it and he thinks he's trying to create this alternate identity, it's the mental wear of, I'm still being a superhero. And I don't have my friends and family that I had when I was Clark, which gives him that regret that he wants to bring it back. There's too many time issues to really be able to fully grasp this. And unfortunately, I think that's Morrison's writing style. And
I've always found his shit confusing. Yeah. Always. I mean, he comes up with good stories. I will not fault him that. They're with interesting ideas, with certainly interesting execution, but they've always felt jumbled to me.
Yeah. Keeping what he wants you to know straight is often the problem.
Good luck.
Yeah. Or there's just a little hint here and a little hint there.
Yeah.
Which is great if you're...
Some people like that. Some people like not having it completely flat laid out for them and figuring it out on their own. You know, that's how they get their enjoyment, but... Not to say that I don't. There are times that I like that. I don't expect it in a straight-up Capes and Cowls book like this. Yeah. I would expect that type of thing to exist in a noir story or...
Well, I mean, I could even see it in a Batman where you're trying to solve a detective case. Yeah. And you've got to use... And that's part of the detectiveness. It makes you feel like you're solving it yourself as well. That makes sense. Here, it's just trying to figure out what time is this taking place versus the previous issue that I read.
Or if you're going to do something more surrealistic, like, say, a game in Sandman or something.
Right.
Where you do have this sort of quasi-mental, not fully cohesive story in the first place, then that type of artistic style goes along with it.
Yeah.
But certainly not for a straight-up story like this. Yeah. We mentioned Prez earlier, so it makes sense to move on to World's Finest, which Prez did the art on. And I wanted to speak for this book specifically about the art, which,
all right,
granted, we're doing an audio podcast, so talking about art kind of seems counterproductive. productive here.
There's still things you could say about the art that's good, it's bad, it's neutral.
Well, it's very good in this one, specifically yes. because one of the things that I know you and I don't know if we've talked about it before on here, but I know we've talked about before, we both are big, big fans of Amanda Connor.
Yes.
And the fact that she does have a slightly more cartoonish style, but her biggest strength is in depicting emotion and doing it very subtly, but very expressively. And in here, specifically, the scene where they are having their little meeting in some tower-ish type thing. Yeah. I don't know where it is. Almost looks like the Seattle Needle or something.
Yeah.
But there's a scene where they have this playful back and forth banter. And in here, you can really see how much Kara is the playful, more bombastic, outgoing. Her emotions are much more varied throughout all the panels. Whereas Helena's are very stoic. It doesn't change a whole lot. I mean, there's some variation.
She does have you know, there is emotions.
She is emoting, but by and large, they're not very drastic changes. Mm-hmm. So you get that great dichotomy between the two characters, and it's all done through a series of basically talking head panels.
Yes, but you're right. And, you know, it does show you just how much Helena is that business first. Yeah, let's get things done properly, do the right thing. And you've got, Power Girl, who's just, you know, Karen, who's a bit more whimsical. There's a beautiful panel in here, and I remember cracking up when I first read it, where she just, out of the side of her mouth, blows the papers that Helena's looking at out of the file.
Which Helena, by the way, does grab in the next panel, which I thought that was very nice to see. Just a quick whoosh.
Yeah. So, the art here was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was that panel, and also the one, if you look, the exact opposite of the next page, where Power Girl's kind of twirling her hair and has a sort of type of look on her face, which elicits a response from Helena in the panel after that one.
Yeah.
Those are really, really great. A little bit further on in the book, there's a fantastic nod to the original Power Girl character, or maybe not original, but the more recent one that a lot of people know, where she actually is wearing a
slinky dress.
Yeah, like a cocktail dress, but has the boob window.
Yeah. It's actually a wonderful panel, and for those of you that have been missing it.
I will say the one thing in this that does kind of confuse me is, did she cut her hair when she went to put on that dress? Or?
Not, I think, specifically for that, but that's what they actually do deal with a couple of different times in here, and that's one of the ways that you can tell whether they're at an older time period when she has her long hair, and the more recent
where it's
period
shorter.
where she's shorter.
Well, what's interesting here is you see the hairstyle for in the slinky dress shot with great big star on the back, and that itself I thought was a nice little homage type of thing too. But if you go almost to the end of the book, and her hairstyle at the end of it, whereas throughout the book it's kind of flared out and it moves around a whole lot, at the end it all of a sudden turns into like helmet hair, where it's this weird angled, cut, chopped, like exactly in place haircut that just looks
odd. It's kind of a swept back, maybe even feathered would probably be the term that they would want to use for that.
But it looks like it's such like a harsh edge to it. Well, I can't believe I'm sitting here fucking discussing hairstyles.
But women change their hair, and I think that's one of the actual geniuses about the art in here is, depending on what she's doing, she's changing her hair. Mm-hmm. You know, she's going out, it's not that swept back, it's more business and more, I'm going out to pick up on a guy because he has some information I want to get from him.
Right.
You know, see
certainly the playful, I suppose.
And even on that same page where she's in the Power Girl dress, she's got her hair pulled back. She's wearing a ball cap, and it's a much more relaxed kinda look.
Almost college student in a way.
Yeah. So they're depicting. Yeah, it's that emotion that you're talking about with the characters. You understand exactly how they're feeling and changing when they're using these different hairstyles.
And you get it at a glance.
Yeah.
Which, going back to what we were talking about on Action Comic, we're getting all of this from a glance from that art. Whereas in Action, they were potentially trying to do the same type of effect, but it wasn't getting conveyed. So there's a very obvious disconnect there that does not occur here.
Yes.
Moving on to the same universe that Power Girl and Huntress come from. We'll look at Earth 2, which will finish up our DC books for this week. Earth 2, I think, was one that you wanted to talk a bit more about, so why don't you go ahead and fire off on this one.
Well, the majority of this book deals with the Green Lantern getting his powers, mm-hmm. and it's actually a much more unique power set than it was. Yeah, before it was a lantern that gave him magical abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's interesting because they're actually tapping into something they've discussed in some of the other books, some of the books that I know you're reading.
Right.
Which is, he's actually powered by the green, the life force of the Earth. And
but we have to remember that this is a different Earth.
I'm not saying it's good or bad. I think it's what I find interesting is that they're pulling that concept through to the different Earths.
Yeah.
And they're using it to create the character.
And applying it differently, which I have to admit, I think is, well, not necessarily a genius masterstroke, is a very interesting one, and one that is certainly worth exploring further. Beyond that, we also see this sort of main antagonist that is coming up, which is very parallel, to draw the same parallels of what's occurring, say, in Swamp Thing and Animal Man right now.
Right.
Which they are dealing with another manifestation called the black, which is the rot. So there's the green, which is plant life, the red, which is animal life, and now the black, which is the rot.
Yes.
Here we have
the gray.
The gray, which is essentially the same thing, but whereas now the green has a champion, which in the original world is Swamp Thing, and this world is Green Lantern, the rot, or the gray in this, now has their champion, which, looking back, like, if you think Blackest Night era, which this is very, very reminiscent of, yes. You would think Black Hand or Necron. And a matter of fact, there is one scene in here, I think you're actually on the panel right now. I saw that and I thought Black Hand.
Yeah.
That was my first thought when I saw that panel.
Definite.
Yeah. And I have a feeling they did that on purpose.
Yeah.
And then you get the reveal. Well,
Black Hand is coming back in the Green Lantern comic. So. Yeah.
Which is kind of why I had that same parallel. And just a couple pages after, you get the reveal of who it actually is, and I'll go ahead and I'll spoil it here, Solomon Grundy.
Which is a beautiful choice.
Very interesting.
Now, he's been the zombie that keeps coming back in the DC in the main DC universe back in the old universe. So to bring him back into as this character where it is that corruptive force that destroys plant life and kills animal life, you know,
it's a good fit.
Yeah.
It's a good fit. But also, if you remember correctly, I believe it was the Superman backstory, we just saw Grundy there as well.
No, I think that's the Batman Beyond universe, which is its own universe.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. You are correct. Okay.
We can't count that. That's a different. I do find it interesting. Like, the reason that Green Lantern has a ring is it's the engagement ring he was going to give to his boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So they've tied in a lot of that angst to create the backstory for Green Lantern. But it's going to be interesting to see, because typically Solomon Grundy in the past, and I know I'm jumping around with thoughts here, Grundy in the past was a giant hulking behemoth of a person.
Yeah.
Very strong. More kind
of Frankenstein-esque.
Yeah. Frankenstein-esque. Gollum, very strong.
Really.
But not the smartest thing. And was pretty much limited to physical strength and invulnerability. Here, he's got a whole new power set.
Yeah. So this is one that they're making interesting choices on that could have amazing payoff if they play their cards right.
Well, I think they're playing a little bit looser with the deck on Earth, too. I think they've.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, they've said, there were some. You could only go so far with Superman, you can only go so far with Batman. Wonder Woman, there's been some backlash about changing up of her backstory, mm-hmm. although the character is essentially the same. So, Hal really hasn't changed pretty much at all from the previous.
Which was something that they said even going into the reboot was that
Green Lantern and Batman weren't changing very much at all.
Because they were successful books before the reboot.
They were just going to compress the events of their time.
Yeah. They ain't broke, don't fix them.
So, Earth 2, they're completely revamping the entire characterizations from the fact that in the DC universe, they'd been the old timers and training the next upcoming generation.
Right.
And we're still, and we're always kind of playing a second fiddle to the Justice League mm-hmm. and the Teen Titans. Mm-hmm. Now they're featured on their own, they're back on their own Earth. They're featured there, so it gives them the chance to be shining stars without being in the shadow.
Yeah. Well, not even featured, but they're being brought up there. I mean, they're starting at ground level, so you can grow with these characters and really see them develop into what they can eventually be. And like you said, as far as playing kind of fast and loose with this world, it's making Earth 2 sort of like the writer's playground.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun to read in there because
yeah, it feels like they
don't
can...
feel like they're constrained to much of what they need to. It's like the character's name was this, and they're mm-hmm. keeping the personalities to the large extent, which is important
yeah.
because that's what you need to keep the character is to have those personalities. But they're changing up power sets. They're changing how those powers actually work and are effective. And I think it's going to create a universe that can be more fun, a lot more fun to read because you don't know what to expect because you can't have the same stories because they're all, everything has been shuffled around so much.
It feels like they can go ahead and F up on something in this world and it's okay. They can make a huge wrong turn and go, okay, nope, that was wrong. And turn right around, recollect themselves back in and go, all right, that didn't work. Let's try this direction instead. And the readership isn't going to be too shooken up about it because it's not that, you know, you've altered the fundamental, you know, the form of the character and the iconography and everything else about that particular character.
Here they've got it so much. What's interesting is, you know, to put it in terms of chess, for all officially sanctioned chess.
That's what I was looking for. Socratic form.
Okay. If we were discussing chess here, they keep a book of every move that's been done in competition play for the sanctioned games. Mm-hmm. And as soon as a game, you know, a move that's never been done is considered off book. And as soon as you go off book, anything can happen. For things that have been done on book, they know how they're likely to be turned out because usually they've been done multiple times.
Right.
So they know how many times a move is done, how it's been countered, and they can account for all that and they know where that game is going to head. Yeah, from
which
that
way it
point
worked,
up.
Which way it didn't.
Yeah. Once a game goes off book, all bets are off because they have no basis for where things are going. And Earth One is being written in book. These are games that have been played before, and while there's certain things that are occasionally you're hitting a point that's off book,
right.
They're very close to the end of the game, and they're not that effective. Whereas with Earth 2,
or at least,
everything
at least they're
is
trying
off book.
To. I would say Earth 1 is, they're trying to play the perfect game. Yes. They're trying to get it so, okay, this is exactly what it needs to be.
And Earth 2, they're playing completely off book.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it fun. So.
I think
Earth 2, the more I read it, the more I want to read.
Mm-hmm.
At least right now, they're heading in a direction of, this is really darn good.
Yeah, which, to go back quick to World's Finest, is an interesting part on that one, because it's Earth 2 characters, but supplanted into Earth 1. So, you have these two characters that they can play a little bit more fast and loose with, but they're still going to have to exist in this, as you put it on the book, world. So, I don't know how much flex they're really going to give them, which makes me more hesitant on that one than I am on reading Earth 2, as far as keeping it on my pull list. Mm-hmm. But I've enjoyed the characters enough so far, and it's sustained itself to keep it on there. That one's going to be... I'll be less forgiving with that book if something goes awry with it than I will with Earth 2.
Yeah, but... And I feel the same way. Earth 2 definitely has a stronger pull for me. It's much more compelling.
Mm-hmm.
But World's Finest is definitely a strong book and one that I'm enjoying each week. And yeah, when it comes out, it's definitely one of the books that I want to get to read.
Yeah.
It's not and one that
it's
I'm
kind of float. Well, I would say for me, it floats to the top of my stack. For you, it floats to the bottom of yours because you keep all your favorites till the end.
That gets me to read the books that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And faster.
So screw I can get to the ones that, that. I'm going to read books because they're entertaining. And if they end up on the bottom of my stack too long, they get off, they're off my pull list.
If they're on the top of my stack too long, they're off the pull list.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, new ones onto our pull list, or at least a new one for this week. The Cape, 1969.
I'll argue that new because The Cape is a series that we've both enjoyed. This is the real, this is the prequel to that.
Yep.
So it's a new series, but it's still in that universe that yep. we've enjoyed.
Well, I don't know. I would actually almost kind of pull it outside of that universe because it's occurring something on the, well, the scale of 30 years before yep. the events of The Cape. So it's a different world than what you come from as,
yeah.
The different world theme song told us. This follows the story of the father of the main character from The Cape and is supposed to tell the story of how The Cape came into existence in the first place. In this first story, or this first issue, we still don't see any of that yet. This is more of building the situation and the conflict in,
this
I think,
introduces
the book as a whole.
Us to the main characters of the first the original Cape book and uh-huh. the miniseries, it introduces us to their father.
Right.
Who's not present in the original series.
Because he did.
The original one shot in the original, in the first, in right. the follow up series.
He is mentioned, but that is all.
Yes. So, yeah, this is actually following him and will eventually give us the origin of the Cape, mm-hmm. where it came from, and why it has the oddball powers that it has.
Right.
And
we kind of see some hints of that in here, but like I said, more and more, this is just, it's all set up. This first book is almost completely set up.
Yeah. Well, there is a couple of little notes, on the cape itself. There is a little patch sewn on
that
featuring a
came
lightning
from
bolt.
His father.
Yeah. And if you look you can see it on the military uniform
right.
in several of the panels. You can see that patch that's sewn onto the jacket.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing that I had about this is this book so far, if you didn't know about the cape and that the cape itself has some mystical powers, mm-hmm. would never know that there's anything mystical going on in this book. This
right.
is the book that I was hoping DC would be putting out with Sergeant Rock, with G.I. Combat. This
yeah,
is a
straight up war story.
This is a Vietnam 1969 war story about a chopper that gets shot down.
Yeah. And I would dare say not a bad one either.
No. If DC was writing this book, I'd still be, I'd have kept buying the, Sergeant Rock book that they were, Men of Valor. And
that being said, if DC was writing this book, it wouldn't be nearly as graphic. Because there's some very, very graphic.
They would have dropped it up into the, popped it up into their
Vertigo line, definitely.
Yeah.
Which, if Cape was in DC, it would have been Vertigo anyways.
Yeah.
Just like the original Cape books, which, to kind of give a quick history, The Cape was originally a short story written by Joe Hill, the son of legendary writer Stephen King, who also does the phenomenal books Lock and Key.
Yeah. Joe Hill writes Lock and Key.
Yes.
Not his father.
No,
his father.
I want to say the first issue or two he may have tied in.
No.
I'm thinking American Vampire. I think American Vampire.
Okay.
That's Raphael Albuquerque.
And they worked together on another book on Road Rage, the two of them.
Road Rage, yeah. Anyways, Hill writes this short story called The Cape. That short story gets translated into a one-shot comic.
Right.
The one-shot comic sells like friggin' hotcakes, so they turn it into a short run,
right.
which also sells like hotcakes,
and
by and
large.
It's
a continuation of the story
right.
that's written in there.
And now we come to this, which is the prequel. They have all been very graphic from the get-go.
Yes.
The art style, I should mention, in here is very, very similar to the art style in The Cape, but there are some subtle differences which, oddly, make me think of things like Peter Panzerfaust, also make me think of Chew, reminds me a little bit of American Vampire in a few places, actually. So, and all of these that I'm mentioning are all books that I really like. I really like the art of and the art style. So to get this as like an amalgamation of all of those is, I think, really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
It's, the tones are always kept very, kind of mellow and drab to really give you that, oppressive feeling. The shadows are done in a, pixelated, but almost a pointillism kind of shading.
The more old school comic shading when they had to be using silkscreen to get the
right.
colors in there.
which gives it a very specific kind of flavor and feel to it. You don't really get that from the cover too much, looking at it. You can kind of see it a little bit, but it's much more evident in the interior art. So, like you mentioned, I would recommend anybody that likes just war stories and those style of books would be worth picking this up. If you read The Cape, obviously you're going to want to continue with this anyways. If you have not read The Cape and you're thinking about picking this up by itself, you can. It's a different, very different story. So don't read this expecting to get an idea of what The Cape is like.
Well, the interesting thing is I'm not even sure I would recommend this for a fan of a war story.
Why is that?
Because this is going to change tones. I really think this will. Because of the story of The Cape, I can really see this changing tones, and there'll still be the elements in there, but.
Well, but that's not to say that somebody that does like war stories won't still enjoy having that fantastic element put into it as well. I mean, go back and look at The Cape. Although it was a very fantastic story, it was strongly rooted in a,
the character's
almost
emotions.
Brutally realistic world.
Yes.
So.
The character's emotions, the character's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A great example of that is, I think it's in the second issue of the actual mini run, where he's trying, the main character can fly, and he picks up a bear, and he's trying to fly with a bear, and he's bitching about how much the frickin' bear weighs. Physics in action. I mean, yeah. We're dealing with, you know, a realistic world with that one singular fantastic facet to it.
Yeah. Now, one thing that's interesting since we were talking about the artwork is, Zach Howard, who did the original Cape artwork, did page one, panel one of art, which is of the two boys as kids with their mother.
Yeah.
And the rest of this is art by Nelson Daniel. So, yeah, there is definitely an artist change, but it's interesting that they
almost kind of a pass the torch kind of thing in a way.
Yeah. It's what ties the two together graphically. Right. And they're not so dissonant that you sit there and go, these were two entirely different art styles.
Yeah. Which we've seen in other books before, and it's very jarring when that happens.
It can be, yes. And sometimes it's done on purpose.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because you do want that jarring effect. Like, there's a very distinct, definite change in the world that has occurred, you know, like a reality shift or something. And that brings it very much into focus.
And by being just page one, panel one, it's a very distinct artistic decision to have them do that. Of that passing of the torch.
Well, this, like you said before, this is one world, this is another.
Sometimes you'll see in comics where the artist just doesn't have time to finish the work or something's happening.
And they've had
to bring somebody in to try and ape their style to finish it. And that's not the case in this.
It bites the style, but it doesn't do it in a imitative way. It does it in an almost homage.
This is the same feel, this is the same emotions that I can transfer to you, but it's my style.
Of doing it.
So.
Alright. That's enough gushing on that one. Next up that we were going to talk about is the continuation of AVX.
Okay.
Which, this has been Marvel's big story for, it's, you know, the Marvel Summer Blockbuster, kind of, if you want to look at it that way.
Their big crossover event.
Yeah. And we've discussed previously how in the books leading up to now, Scott Summers, Cyclops, leader of the X-Men, has seemed a little bit...
off-kilter?
I was going to say batshit crazy, but yeah, that seems to work too. This is the first time that, at least in perception, he seems to not be quite as crazy-go-nuts.
Well, it's part of the events of the story that he's actually getting what he was wanting and looking for. They have the Phoenix. They're able to protect and defend people, not just the mutant population, which is what he wanted, but the world as a whole.
Yeah.
And from what he's seeing, they're able to make the world as a whole a better place, which makes it a better and safer place for mutants, which is what he cares about. So
creating the utopia that Charles Xavier had always instilled could occur.
His mindset really hasn't changed. The dynamic of the world has shifted to where he's the center, and now he's no longer out on a fringe.
Right. Now, contrary to that, you have the inner group around him who share the Phoenix Force with him, And whereas he seems to be, if not holding it together, at least cognizant of the power and ability that he has, those around him who are a bit less savory, perhaps, don't seem to be coping quite as well and are letting the power get to their heads a little bit. And whereas he has shifted to the center, they've now shifted from the stabilizing agent out to the edge.
Which is interesting because these are characters that weren't ever true stabilizing characters to begin with, and which is part of the reason why they were following Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got Namor, who hates the surface dwellers.
And has for...
Plus, he believes he's higher and above everybody as King of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
So he's always had this holier-than-thou and somehow was able to take up with the X-Men. Emma Frost, who started off as the White Queen and was...
A villain.
Yeah, was
Just a straight-up
villain. And then you've got Colossus and his sister Magic, who have demons inside of them.
Literally.
Yes. And so you're seeing, those that have evil inside of them are now pulling.
Well, have been bestowed an ultimate power, and as the previous incarnation of the Phoenix taught us, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you have that less than pristine base to build from, you're not really going to get very good results out of this.
No. So. It's interesting how they have changed the dynamic of the world and the dynamic of the characters
mm-hmm.
with, because the other part that they did is in round six, the previous issue,
mm-hmm.
they really laid out the X-Men as good guys doing good things and the Phoenix Five were there to protect the world and doing good things. It wasn't until...
Well, but it was the sort of imposed piece, which... Although the idea, I mean, it's an argument of, do the means justify the ends?
Right.
You know, yes, there is this utopian society, mm-hmm. but how deep does that utopia go?
Well, and that's the whole thing, is it started off, they show us the utopia and the utopian society, and the only dissenters were...
The Avengers.
The Avengers. In this one, they now have taken that utopian society and shown us the cracks at the top. Not the cracks at the bottom where the Avengers are, the cracks at the top. Where the Phoenix Five are cracking amongst themselves on what they believe needs to be done and how it needs to be handled.
Which means, and with the power that they have, any single one of them, potentially, could completely change everything.
So
if you don't have that unified vision setting everything up, you end up with a fractured utopia into five separate individual ideals.
But I like that idea of, let's set this up and show you just how perfect and great it could be,
mm-hmm.
even though it was a forced regime. And now they're cracking that and showing you.
Is Marvel saying that fascism is a good thing?
No, in issue six they were, in issue seven, they're not.
Not so much. Well, no, they're just saying that this is what happens if you have multiple leaders in a fascist state. That means you just have to have one and it'll be all right.
I propose the Red Skull. Let's see how that carries.
Well. Not like he hasn't tried.
No, that's been pretty much his goal.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you gotta think he's gonna be sitting back somewhere just pissed. Just looking around going,
he's dead.
Oh, yeah.
His daughter.
Yeah. Like, isn't she in some, like, prison in Asgard or some crap now?
Yeah.
She got beat with her own hammer or something. I wasn't paying attention.
You were the one that read yourself. I didn't.
I read it, but I read it in the sense of like, oh, look, there's another hammer. You know, I didn't really pay that close attention.
Okay. So.
There were some like Tron glowy line things.
Ooh, that's because the movie came
Hulk got kind of angry. And it was, standard Marvel story.
Hulk splash.
Yeah, that just means he has to wipe twice as much.
Yeah, that's what happens when he does a cannonball into the country club pool.
No, I was just thinking he was taking a crap. Anyways, leaving you on that lovely visual, in case you're curious, there's a statue of it somewhere in a mall in Korea. It's hilarious.
It is.
It is absolutely
hilarious. It's on the internet. You can find it.
Yep. Everything's on the internet. Rule 34. Anyways,
That's not Rule
34. Shush!
I really don't want to see it.
Do not bring that into... well, I shouldn't say anything. I started it.
I do not want to see it. I do not want to see Rule 34 of the Hulk kicking of crap.
For all of you listening at home and are wondering, what is this Rule 34 thing? I implore you, save yourself. Do not look it up on the internet. You will only be harming yourself. This public service announcement has been brought to you by, who do you want to bring it by? by Ultimate Spider-Man, because that's what we're going to talk about next, and I can't think of a good fake ad to do, so. I knew I should have written this shit out ahead of time.
Yes.
Anyways,
Ultimate Spider-Man.
Oh, planning's for pussies. Ultimate Spider-Man, this ends the arc between Miles Morales and his uncle, the Prowler.
And it ends big.
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely gone with a mentality of go big or go home on this title. In everything it's done so far. And more so, do you want to go ahead and spoil the shit out of this? Or we've done it with enough books this show. We might as well keep up with the.
Really? Because I was going to say we should leave one for everybody to be not that spoiled on. This is going to have a big payload for Miles' emotional stability and why and what he will do as Spider-Man moving forward. I will say that.
Yeah, that's definitely. And it's in the same vein and the same motivation.
It's actually the opposite motivation for Parker, if that's where you're headed with it.
Well, if nothing else, it's exactly what this entire book is, which is an amazing contrast.
Yeah.
And we see this as well, you know, looking at the Spider-Men title that's been coming out, which even when we were going through and writing up stuff in the first place, I kept calling this Spider-Men.
Yes, and I had to correct you. No, it's man, not men. Yeah, it's like, only.
Oh, shit, that's right.
This is Miles' this is the solo story.
Well, because Miles' character is so interesting to be that sort of, I don't want to say contrasting agent again, because I don't want to keep beating that dead horse.
Yeah.
But he is even better, a reflection of the Peter Parker Spider-Man. But it's the funhouse reflection, where it's a little warped here and a little distorted there, but in ways that do nothing more but to help broaden the character and broaden the idea of what Spider-Man is and can be.
And this really changes, you know, who Miles will be as Spider-Man. Yeah, you know,
doesn't change the core though. It's still Spider-Man being Spider-Man. It's a change of motivation. It's a change of approach vector, if you want to think of it that way.
Actually, what it is it's the vulcanization or the tempering of that character within Miles.
Both characters have had, but just in different ways.
Both were the catalyst agent for both of those has been the uncle.
Right.
Which is that mirror aspect you were talking about, but that's the catalyzing agent. In the tempering or the vulcanization of who Miles is as Spider-Man.
Yeah.
It hardens his resolve to be who he is.
And to act.
Because
the way
it's going to do two things. It's either going to temper him or it's going to shatter him.
Right.
And if it shatters him, we don't have a book to read.
So.
Well, I take that back because it could shatter.
It could make it a very interesting book. If you have a fractured and broken Spider-Man out trying to do heroic things,
would he be able to be out there and doing Spider-Man things if he's that fractured and broken?
Look at Peter Parker. For years, that guy has been the
punching bag of the Marvel
Universe. Yes. If you want to talk about people that are broken, he's been broken by the best and multiple times.
He hasn't.
But he's still, well, and that's the thing.
Even that core is still there. It's still solid. The question is what happens if this actually cracks that core?
Well,
because the core here
is... That'll be the neat kind of thing. So it'll be that flip reflection. With Parker, it's the guy gets beat on, but he still has his solid center. What happens if you have a solid facade of somebody that has had an example shown to them of what they should and could be, but don't have that stable center to really pull it off? Can they act it out well enough and still be the hero that...
Fake it till you make it?
Basically, yeah.
I think this
it's a tough pull, but that would be a very interesting way to look at this
character. It'd be a very interesting way to look at this arc and to build a couple of arcs from. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you could act. I think you would have to wind up having the hero fail. I think that's where it's its weak point.
Well, and I think that would be okay with this character. He's so young that he can have that failure and grow up with it and have a point later where that flip does occur, where he does get more tempered over time.
And I see if he fails, it's over. It's done with, the costume's hung up, and I don't see him feeling that he can carry on. Which is why I think it leads to the demise of the book.
Possibly. I don't know.
But then again, you know, there could be other catalysts that go in there and save it in the end.
Going back to the metaphor of tempering, you temper once, sure, you're going to get a strong blade, but it's going to be more fragile. But if you
over-temper something...
If you anneal it, so it's up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, so you get that general, gradual, over time tempering, you come up with a much stronger, more flexible... And he's young enough that he has the time to do it that way.
Right. Well, yeah, if you take an accent, a tempered accent, if it's not tempered enough, it gets dull.
Right.
It gets dull fast, and you have to keep resharpening it.
Yeah.
If it's tempered just right... You can get a sharper
edge on it, but yeah.
If it's just right, it's going to keep that edge and hold on to it for a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
If you over-temper it, when you hit it against that log, it's going to shatter.
Right.
So the question is where's Miles going to fall on that
Well, field? Not just how hard can he be pushed and where is that line, but... It's a little bit different because his line can shift.
He's been pushed past where he's that soft edge that he's going to have to keep resharpening.
Mm-hmm.
But has he been pushed past the point where he's going to shatter?
Don't know. And that's where this book will continue on.
Yes. All right. So, speaking of Spider-Man, I went out and was able to catch The Amazing Spider-Man, the new movie that came out just before July 4th.
Which I've heard from certain sources that Amazing Spider-Man is amazing.
I talked to a couple people and had heard some mixed reviews. I had a lot of fun at the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I did feel it was a little bit long and slow particularly at the beginning.
Okay.
They were trying to build up a rapport with Spider-Man, and Andrew Garfield just was too angsty for me. And I realize it's Spider-Man and there's going to be angst in the character. It is about him being picked on by Flash in high school.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship between Spidey and Gwen Stacy as the love interest didn't quite feel organic. There were parts of it that were kind of stretched and pushed a bit.
Okay.
She should have been somebody a bit less available to him. In the way that they presented it.
Well, with Andrew Garfield playing Parker, it's kind of almost like a pretty boy Parker, which is contrary to...
They actually got him to tone down a little bit, but there were still elements of him
up a bit.
There was still too much of the element of him being the cool guy that could be. Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. he's carrying a skateboard, and I think that's to try and get him relatable to a modern audience. Problem is, Parker was supposed to be, you're supposed to relate to him as being a geek and a dweeb, and they're trying to get a general population audience to relate to this kid. He worked well in the comic books because the geeks and the dweebs are the ones that are reading comic books.
Right. But in a movie
audience, you've got a much broader audience you've got to try and attract him to, and they had to kind of shift the focus to aim it there. There were definitely elements that seemed too cool for school with him.
Looking back at the other Spider-Man movies, the Raimi ones, mm-hmm. even in those, he had a very cool, he was geeky, no doubt, but he had that cool edge to him. There's never really been a full-on dork Spider-Man, or a dork Peter Parker that's been portrayed in the movies. And probably for that exact same reason. They just probably don't think it'll sell.
Oh, yeah, because you do have to be able to feel for your character and connect to him. But I think that they were able to do it better in the Raimi movies, particularly in the first one.
You know, actually, now that I think about it, with having Parker being the dork-type character, and especially after he gets bitten and becomes Spider-Man, or at least gets the spider powers, it's very much that the ugly librarian who takes off the glasses, lets down the hair, and is the beautiful girl. This is like the male version of it.
Yes,
it really is. It's the dork at the beginning of the movie. He gets bit, he takes off his glasses, and oh, look, he's a movie star.
Yeah. And
a guy that you paid money to come see. Ha ha.
And, you know, there are definitely some great action sets in this movie. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun to be had as he, you know, starts discovering he's got these powers. He did all of a sudden learn some kung fu after getting bitten.
Maybe it was a Matrix spider.
They tried to go for a little bit of slapstick as he discovers his powers. Some of it kind of worked. Some of it didn't quite fit.
I don't think slapstick would fall flat in a movie like this, especially one that's a bit more Dawson Creek.
It did fall a little bit flat. I know I heard some chuckles in the theater, but for me, that scene fell rather flat.
Okay.
They really do change up the origin story and a lot of the things that you're used to seeing. Uncle Ben does not say with great power comes great responsibility.
Sacrilege.
But he talks around it.
Alright.
So, you get that impression.
He's getting the idea across
without actually saying it.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't actually join a wrestling contest to win money.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. But he does happen to fall through a roof and land in a wrestling ring, which gives him the idea for a Lucha Libre mask.
Okay.
That and the fact that the guy that he was going after was screaming, I know who you are, I see in your face.
Yeah.
So between that and seeing the Lucha Libre mask in a wrestling ring, he gets the idea. There's no actual wrestling for money. They did an interesting take off of, you know, the guy stealing money and how is that my problem?
Right.
For the guy that kills Uncle Ben.
Mm-hmm.
In
fact, Uncle Ben does still die.
Yes.
Spoiler.
Spoiler alert! Uncle Ben dies in the origin of Spider-Man. Ah!
Hey, Spider-Man! You know what my favorite brand of rice is? Uncle Ben's! Ah! Okay, the real question about this whole thing, though, and the most important thing, I think, to come out of this, how was Dennis Leary?
Actually, a part of me really liked his performance, part of me was upset.
Because it was Dennis Leary being Dennis Leary?
No, because it was Dennis Leary being held back. It's a PG-13 movie, and there are moments when you see him getting ready to rage, and he's getting ready to go on a rant, and he can't. And it's through no fault of his own.
It's depressing.
He has to play Gwen's father, and he does a good job, and there are moments there where you kind of get this idea of, looking down the Leary double barrel shotgun.
Yeah.
Only to have the little bang flag pop out of it. Leary, okay. He does a great job acting, but if you're a fan of Leary and his rants and are looking to see him going
just royal on somebody.
Especially there was a perfect scene where Peter goes over to have dinner and of course he meets Captain Stacy, Gwen's father. And there's just a moment in there where you're just expecting if they had said, okay, here's what we've got written, Dennis, please rewrite this and we're going to have you do your rant and go off and give Peter both barrels. It would have been great, but
what would have been really funny is to tell him to write it as he would have originally done it and then take everything that wouldn't fly past the censors. And, like, take all of the words, like, the individual words down to something that would pass.
Well,
so that way it would be perfect because it would be Leary doing a Leary rant as only Leary can. But for every time he comes across one of those words, you would actually see him kind of, like, physically flinch to not say what he wanted to and to say the new word instead. So it's, you get that feeling a father would have of, I just want to rail into you, but
I can't say that because I got two young kids right next.
Exactly.
And there was moments
that would have been brilliant. That would have been fantastic.
Yeah, if they didn't let him write some rants in there, it would have been great. But there was another moment where Emma talks to him when he's in the hallway and asks her if she wants some hot chocolate, and she's got Peter in the room, so she's declining, and she starts coming up with other excuses, and some of the looks on his face were pure classic Leary. If you followed him Rescue Me, some great. And I kind of wish you'd have seen a bit more of that. So yes, it was a letdown from the Leary side. Andrew Garfield, passable for Spider-Man.
Okay. Yeah. Have they said they're going to continue with this franchise?
Passable? Oh, there is no doubt. Okay. Want to couple other things. Sally Field plays Aunt May.
Right.
Which, huge name.
Mediocre
performance. I wish there, part of me wants her to have had a bit more presence. Like, she didn't have, like, you know, if she's gonna threaten somebody. I want Aunt May to feel like there's a threat there, and I just didn't feel like that. But
was
she
it,
did
was
have-
it just because of the character? Because of the character, or because of the actress? Because I can guarantee you, Sally Field can be intimidating. And if you don't believe me, go see Eye for an Eye.
I think it was the way the part was written.
Okay.
Maybe it was her and the way that she presented it. Maybe they just pulled her back, kind of like Leary was pulled back.
Yeah. Which could very well be a, you know, we gotta...
It could have also been a creative decision in that the dominant home figure for Peter, the one that did have that presence...
Was Ben.
Was Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
And Martin Sheen.
Which he has presence. I mean, he could play any character. He just...
He ruled. And if it wasn't for the fact that he dies early in the movie, he would have just completely... And the fact that they kept him at pretty much the home scenes, he would have dominated the entire movie with his presence. And it's the reason why The West Wing had him in it. He was... The president was not supposed to be seen... During the West Wing TV show, they were supposed to be maybe 5 minutes, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, because
if
you work in DC, if you're working on the Hill, and especially if you're working for a president, that's all you ever see of him.
Well,
even
the
if
idea,
you work for the guy,
the show was the West Wing was pitched as the people that are the support staff for the president.
Yeah.
So you might see him just tweaking in and out of meetings.
Just sticking a head in the doorway, you know.
Martin Sheen came in, blew everybody away that they said, we need to keep him in the show.
Yeah.
He needs
well,
to
can't
be
get rid of him
awesome.
Now. Great.
So, and he
Way
did
go,
that
Martin.
Here with Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you're kind of going, you can't kill Uncle Ben. I need more Martin Sheen. And part of me was scared that he would, that I would
I
be,
loved you on Wall Street.
I.
Sorry.
Part of me was going, do I want to, you know, was, I was really worried that I would be sitting there going, Mr. President, the whole time that he was on screen, and I didn't. He was able to take in a bit of a fatherly figure, which he actually did on The West Wing as well, but take in that fatherly, you know, pronouncement in dealing with Peter and, you know, become a father figure instead of what I was worried about is of him going, of just being, saying, oh, it's Martin Sheen, it's the president.
Yeah.
So he was able to fit into the role, which was great.
Now I'm thinking about it. Was Martin Sheen Wall Street?
No, you're thinking of Charlie Sheen.
Well, Charlie Sheen, yeah, but who was it that played, the guy who got arrested at the end of it?
Gecko?
Yeah.
Gordon Gecko?
Yeah. Who played Gecko?
great. Now.
I can see his face, I just can't think of his name. It wasn't Martin. Ah, well, screw it. Never mind. Well, you're looking that up. You mentioned.
There were two other things with this, and then we'll get onto your question. Rhys Ifans plays Dr. Connors, and I enjoyed the performance. I had no complaints about the performance, but
I did hear people complain that the lizard kind of looked like one of the Goombas from the old Super Mario Brothers movie.
Actually, that's one thing that I would have liked to have seen is as he's going through, he's injecting himself with more and more and more of the serum. I would have loved to have seen a progression in the reptile. As it went from the first transformation of a fairly human but scaled reptile to
more kind of killer croc-esque to then the more animalistic
to a more animalistic, more reptile looking because he eventually just had kind of a rounded face, and I would have loved to have seen them just push the envelope. You know, they could have even started.
May
doing,
not have had the budget for it.
It was all CG. It would have cost the same. Just adding in a couple, you know, maybe a ridge of spines like you'd see on the back of an alligator type.
Yeah.
Maybe they purposely stayed away from an alligator look with the reptile and giving him the long snout or ridge spines. I think it would have been a cool aspect to push the transformations further and further each time. But Emma Stone stole the show as Gwen Stacy. I think she did an amazing job her interactions with Andrew Garfield. And I also like that they actually gave her a fairly significant role as opposed to just playing the girlfriend. She actually helps to save the day.
Okay. So they definitely make her a bit more of a more empowered character than
And, you know, they were, she worked the
standard damsel in distress type of thing that MJ usually.
Yeah, she was definitely not a damsel in distress, although there were moments when she was in danger. Yeah. She was not.
Which that was something a lot of people liked from Gwen Stacy in the original comics as well, is that she was never really, she wasn't a pushover character. She was never that damsel in distress type archetype. She was a very strong female character.
Yeah.
In the comics.
And and Emma Stone does an amazing job portraying that here. She is a full-fleshed human being and, you know, really stood out for me in acting above, you know, even Andrew, who's opposite her.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, yeah, they gave her a good role in that she actually plays a role in resolving the whole story that goes on there.
Okay.
There were some plot hole issues. There were some, okay, that's kind of corny. We want everybody to cheer type of a thing.
Oh, okay.
Spidey saves somebody's kid earlier in the movie and the guy wants to pay Spider-Man back by getting all his friends on the horn to help Spidey get where he's going.
Yeah. Stan Lee cameo?
Stan Lee does have a cameo. Okay, it's actually quite humorous that they played through it quite well. It did kind of stick out a little bit, but you're kind of going,
It's Stan Lee.
He's allowed to. Well, it's Stan Lee. Let's have this.
Give him the moment.
It's almost a cornball moment, really, going back to like that slapstick moment. It really kind of stands out from the rest of the film when played in context.
Right.
But yeah, Stan Lee definitely, you know, he gets more than just, you know, 30 seconds. Well, I guess it probably is about 30 seconds, but it's a continuous 30 seconds.
Ooh! Michael Douglas.
Gordon Gekko, yes.
Michael Douglas.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Sorry.
So.
Hey, this is the shit that happens in my brain, people.
Yep. All right. As for sequels, they start this off by actually showing you Peter living with his parents.
Mm-hmm. And oh, really?
An event happens that you see his parents leaving him with his aunt and uncle. You're just going to be with them for a little while. And that's the last you really see of them.
That's interesting. That's something that's never really been brought up before.
Not in the movies.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they brought back his parents in the comics. I think that's where they're kind of stealing. I heard
they were spies or some shit.
Yeah, they've had that going on. Ugh. Here, his father's
clone saga.
His dad's a researcher. And this has to do with his dad's research. His dad actually worked with Kurt Connors.
Okay.
And so it ties back in
with that. Tied for the world of the comics, because it was using his dad's equipment that he actually manufactured his webbing, right? Yeah.
And interesting thing is, in here,
something else to ask.
Does have actual web slingers in this. He designs the slingers themselves, but the ammunition
the mechanical,
is stolen.
Not the organic, right?
Yeah. Which the actual webbing that he uses, what's in the cartridges, the cartridges he gets, are actually developed by Oscorp, which is the company brings us right into where we're going. Oscorp is the company that Dr. Connors is working for.
Mm-hmm.
And there's mention of Norman Osborn in this movie, of course, as the president of Oscorp.
Right.
And providing the funding for Dr. Connors' research, as well as everything else going on in Oscorp. So they're definitely leading you to the path of the Green Goblin,
whatever.
Yeah. Whether they decide next movie, which is based on what I've seen in this movie, I would say it's likely Green Goblin and Norman Osborn are going to be the follow-up villain. You're going to find out more about Peter's parents and what's going on there. It's, from what I've been read somewhere, this is set up to be a trilogy. It makes sense to make it a trilogy.
Yeah.
And they're doing it as a cohesive, we're following Peter's parents in this one. More is revealed in the second one.
And the third will be the third conclusion. Yeah.
Concludes that's their story arc as well.
Okay.
So there's definite room for that. Ending of the movie.
I wonder how far Emma Stone is going to make it in that trilogy.
I'll even go ahead and spoil it and tell you she'll make it to the second one.
Well, yeah.
Well, that could have killed her in the first one.
Yeah, I suppose it could have. Yeah. But
I think that they're going to bring her. She'll at least be in the second one, depending on who the villain is, what they plan on doing.
Yeah.
The movie was worth seeing. If you're a Spider-Man fan, go see it in the theaters. If you're if you're a Marvel fanboy, go see it in the theaters. If you're a casual fan.
Right.
Maybe you could wait for it to come out. I don't know that for the story.
What you described, I don't feel like there's really any push or impetus for a fan like I, even though I am a, you know, fan of comics in general and Spider-Man. Right.
You're a general.
But yeah, I'm definitely more the generalist. So I feel like I could wait.
If you need to see your movies on the big screen, it's one that you should go see.
But, yeah, I have a kid. Seeing movies on the big screen is sort of like, that is the big treat. I gotta save that for the ones that are truly, truly worth it.
Yes. Like The Dark Knight coming out on the 20th.
Yup.
So, predicted to make, $200 million its opening weekend. So, Spider-Man actually, I think, broke a record for Tuesday night openings.
Well,
the
previous Dark Knight movie actually broke the opening record, didn't it?
Batman, I believe, did, and yeah. although I think Avengers beat that one. So,
it
could have been Avatar, though. Avengers or Avatar broke the...
Well,
Avatar, the blue skin creatures.
Yeah. Not M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong one.
Right.
Everybody avoided
Avatar.
Well,
everybody avoided Airbender, sorry.
Yeah, everybody avoided Airbender Avatar. After the first night. Because after the first night and all the reviews came out of, this sucks.
Well,
then
actually the sneak previews got those reviews out there. I know I saw the reviews from the previews and it didn't help. Alright, got a couple of news stories to discuss.
I'm gonna actually segue this one. And, you mentioned looking down the double barrel shotgun of Dennis Leary and just getting the bang flag out of the end. Which makes me think of our good buddy from the DC Universe and Batman books specifically, the Joker.
Yes.
The Joker last we saw in Detective Comics number 1 had his face carved off while in Arkham Asylum and has since disappeared.
To be fair, we did see his face appear in Suicide Squad as Harley found it at Gotham's police station.
We've seen his face all over the place.
His face keeps popping up.
But not him being, you know, severely unattached from it at the moment.
But we knew he would pop up. I'm not sure how much of a news story this is. He's a character. He's the main Batman villain.
Right.
So he was going to be popping up.
It's interesting that you say he's the main Batman villain because that has changed from era to era. There have been other times when the Joker is not the iconic Batman villain. Based on a particular period of time.
But overall, the guy that always is feared to come back, the guy that always plays against Batman so well. And
he is the most dangerous of Batman's villains.
The most dangerous to
Batman, at least.
Yeah, this is when you're talking about people like Ra's al Ghul and Bane, among others, that are dangerous for Batman. So, yeah, there's certainly, yeah, he's got his rogues gallery. It's just, you know, for a character to come back, we're dealing with comic books, they're almost always going to come back.
Yeah. And we knew this was going to happen. I mean, from what they showed in Detective, he was out there. It was never a question of that he was going to come back. It was when and how. And the fact that they're bringing him back, not in Detective, but in Batman itself. So we're looking at, if I'm doing my math right, which is very difficult in the DC universe, probably about something in the lines of a 7-year span, give or take.
I would say 5, but yeah, 5,
well,
7
would be I'm going with 5 out from the beginning of the Batman book, and I'm thinking some time after that as well. So I'll pad it out a bit to kind of get past the whole Court of Owls thing and a little more.
Well, if you consider the Court, the
Court
of Owls
obviously didn't take 2 years to do, but.
So we're talking
gonna be
5 to 6 years. Later, that he hasn't shown up in.
So, this has been a lot of time for Joker to be out doing his machinations and setting up stuff for the Dark Knight. And from what, Scott Snyder has said for writing this story is, Joker's been out there and he has got an axe to grind. And he's gonna be coming back in a big, big way. Even, I forget who the artist is on this. I wanna say it's not Capullo, I don't think.
I know they've pulled in a new artist, at least for the launch.
And he said basically when he got the story from Snyder, he lost his shit. He was so ready to jump in and do this book. So I think this is going to be an amazing run. The title of this arc actually is Death of the Family, which harkens back, of course, to the very iconic Batman storyline, A Death in the Family, which resulted in the homicide of then Robin, Jason Todd. One of the most, I would say one of the most talked about comic book events ever. You know, up there along the lines with the death of Superman, which is the death of death, as we've heard people talk about before.
The breaking of the bat, which was
another huge one. Yeah. The Phoenix saga for the Marvel Universe to put something on a
Secret Wars and, yeah, the, where Spider-Man got the cosmic powers with Secret Wars.
Right.
Or the Infinity Gauntlet.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, but this is not in small company here, folks. Mm-hmm. I personally am really looking forward to this. I have a feeling a lot of other people are too, because, like you said, Joker is so iconic. But it is a character thing. I know there's a good number of people out there that don't particularly like Joker. I think he's overused and that they've been, kind of dangling him around out there like a catnip toy or something for the drugged among us to go play with. Well, it's just not their cup of tea. You know, some comics aren't for everybody, and this, obviously, just like anything else, is not going to be for anybody. I do think this will be for a lot of people, though.
I'm really interested to see how Snyder treats Joker.
You know my feelings. I shouldn't have to say them again.
Yeah, you're a Snyder fan.
Big time.
All right.
And if nothing else, and let me put it in this context, the issue of Batman not too long ago where he's having that sort of psychotic break due to the drugs he had ingested.
Yes.
And the way that was written and paneled and everything else, we've seen that Snyder can do that not quite all here mentality type of comics. With him writing Joker, who's already out in the BFE of La La Land, I think this is his wheelhouse. I mean, this is where he lives and plays. This could be, I would dare say, his tour de force as far as what he can come up with.
I hope that. I want to see him writing for a long time.
I want to see him writing for a long time too, but if this becomes his crown jewel, I will not be disappointed.
I can agree with that one. No. I'm looking forward to a lot of stuff from this. It's just, you know, how can you consider a character coming back news? It's one of those things that's tough for me, because we could be talking about characters coming back all the time. You know, Sinister's coming back in Ultimate, right. In Uncanny X-Men. You know, they're just a character, you know, even a villain the magnitude of the Joker.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's kind of the biggest thing.
Mr. Sinister, Doc Ock coming back in Spider-Man.
But has Doc Ock ever had a storyline that people still talk about to this day? That ends comics as a whole talks about
ends
to
of
this
the Earth
day.
Just ended. It was great. Yeah, I don't know that will get up there in stature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you never know.
Sinister is another one. I mean, yeah. Sinister's done some kind of neat stuff, but if you ask people on the street who Mr. Sinister is, people are going to look at you funny.
But I bet you
anybody on the street
the
who the Joker is, they know.
You ask who Warren Worthington III about Mr. Sinister.
Well, yeah.
And you're getting the lead into, you know, Apocalypse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So.
Which people who watched the X-Men comic or the cartoon in the 90s, they would know.
Yeah. It doesn't have the iconicness. There's very few. Doc Ock might have that iconicness with, pretty really big with the, second Spider-Man movie by Sam Raimi. Green Goblin is kind of there.
Yeah, Green Goblin definitely there for like the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Red
Skull is another one that most people.
For Cap fans, absolutely.
Well, yeah. Or even, yeah, anybody outside kind of knows who the Red Skull is based on, who Cap is.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on there. Go ahead and talk about something which is a bit more in your wheelhouse as well.
Hmm.
And that's EA is looking at going all digital. No more physical media for buying your video games.
Which this is going to be very, very interesting. EA holds a damn near monopoly on sports titles, which is a very specific segment of gaming, of gamers, I should say.
Yeah.
And not necessarily the most technically savvy at all times. So they're going to, I think, encounter some difficulty as far as distribution in this model. But it makes a lot of sense to see that they were going this way anyways.
But
EA came out with their Origin service about a year or two ago, and they've been pushing it so heavily.
Now, Origins is their EA's version of Steam, which is a platform where you sign up, you buy games, the service remembers what games you've bought, mm-hmm. and then authenticates the system, whether it's an Xbox or a computer, mm-hmm. that you've bought this game, you have the rights to play it, and allows you to download and play that.
Yeah,
game.
I should mention Origin is specifically PC. It's not for consoles as well. It is PC only.
But EA, with this announcement, may be extending that out to console systems. They could be waiting for the next gen systems to come out. You know, there's already talk about, you know, whether it's going to be the Xbox 720 or the Xbox 1080.
Well, the thing is, they can go full digital distribution now without rolling Origin out to the consoles.
Yeah.
And still get a decent audience. I mean, you'll have guys playing Madden on their Xboxes, and when the new Madden comes out, they'll download the new Madden and probably delete the old one.
Right.
Because, I mean, you generally don't go back and play old roster games when the new one comes out. Sports games roll over year to year to year to keep up with the current state of the sport. Right.
Now, occasionally there are some things, they change some features, and I know some people have said, you know, there's the manager mode where you actually get to manage the team. Yeah. And I believe it was the most recent Madden that didn't have that in there, so they were still playing mode on the previous year's game.
Which, for things specifically like that, yeah, that'll definitely occur. And that kind of ranges all the different EA titles. The bigger problem with this, especially with the consoles, is probably going to be drive space. If you like a lot of different, a wide variety of their sports games, they're not small downloads. I mean, these are big honking games. It's the sheer amount of data alone.
Yeah, it's not something you can go, oh, I haven't played this in a while. Let me download it and I'll start playing in 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, it's not going to happen. Which, that's fine, because people are going to make the room to put it on.
What would be interesting is if they were able to build a system like on Live for the consoles as a lead in to the being able to download and play a fuller version of the game. On Live, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, is basically a
Netflix
box
for video games. Well, kind of.
Not quite, because it's a box, and all that the box does is send a video signal to your TV to display what the video is, mm-hmm. and receive your commands from your keyboard or controller as to what your commands are. It then sends your commands through the internet back to the online servers. The online servers run all of the processing.
Right.
And send just the video signal of what's happening back. So you don't need a high-end computer to do this. Right. You just buy their box, which is about the size of an Apple TV. Mm-hmm. You plug that in and you're off you go.
The problem with that though is, yeah, absolutely. No, really. Because the sports games especially, I mean, there's Madden tournaments out there that can be big money. And the guys that go out and do these need to have that Twitch factor in their games of, you know, fractional second, you know, frame drop timing.
But what if you could use this as a system to get you in, to get you to start setting up your team, check your rosters, get your basic playbook in order for your game of who you're going to be playing against, mm-hmm. see their rosters, and it downloads what it needs to be able to play that game during that time period. Similar to like a load screen or even using it as a cutscene type of a thing.
Yeah, but at that point, then you're looking at, in a way, so almost sort of like mixed media. So you'd have your online service along with your console service, right. And getting things to work together with that. All of that would be looking definitely forward into the next gen, not to work with the current system.
Okay.
Which is why I say one of the problems that they're going to have now with doing this digital distribution, like I said before, is for people that like the wide variety of games. Because say you're getting NBA, MLB, Madden, FIFA, Tiger Woods, and NCAA basketball, NCAA football. That's 7 EA sports titles. And just for the hell of it, Quidditch. They have it.
So you're talking,
let's
four
say,
to 8 gigs per game.
About,
of space.
Yeah.
Because for a DVD, for a single layer DVD, games, you're talking 4 gigs. A double layer is 8.
Yeah. So we're talking on the range of 40 gigs of data. That's a shitload of space. Yeah. And you're going to have to save to the cloud because you're just going to be out of room on your damn drive.
Yeah. Well, but if you're storing on the cloud,
storing the saves only, not the games itself. The games themselves can't be stored on the cloud.
Yeah, because you wouldn't be able to play them. That's what I was about to say. Right. Is you wouldn't, if you're storing on the cloud, you can't play those games until you've got them downloaded.
Exactly.
Now you can buy larger hard drives for your systems. You can
some external drives and stuff like that as well. Yeah.
I know for a while when Sony was really struggling with their PlayStation 3, mm-hmm. I said what they needed to do was call them back, rip out the 100, 250 gig hard drives that were in them, ship everything out with a terabyte, which at that time, terabytes were $100.
Yeah.
And Sony, if they decided to ship everyone out, would have gotten, A, that's $100 to consumers, which means the stores are buying them mm-hmm. for 50 to 75.
Right.
And OEMs would be able to get them 50 to 75. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, if they're buying in bulk, it's even cheaper. Do that. And then everything for the PS3 should have been download. If you've got a terabyte of space for downloading games, now you don't have that.
Which I problem. Do believe, I think Sony said is exactly what they're doing for the next PlayStation. Which, it will be
no
online
physical media.
Only. Yeah, no physical media.
I think I did hear that they were one of the things they were talking about, which is interesting because they've been really wanting, one of the things they were doing, one of the reasons why they didn't do it with the PS3 is they're pushing that for the Blu-ray. That's how they're pushing
the Blu-ray. Well, yeah, they're pushing the platform, definitely.
That's how they were pushing the Blu-ray platform forward. On top of,
I will say, if PlayStation does want to go all digital for the next system, they better get their online system, their play online arena fixed. Because from what I should back up on that. Initially, when it did come out, I had heard it was atrocious. It was a horrible, horrible system. They've improved it since then. I don't know how well it's improved comparatively to Xbox Live. As far as...
Well, the other part with these online gaming services is, do I need to pay for Sony's online service mm-hmm. as well as EA's service right. for their service, plus paying for the game?
Which like for Xbox, PC, you do.
And Well,
well for, and things like Xbox Live and the PlayStation Marketplace.
Right.
PlayStation you can do through PC to a certain extent,
well,
depending upon the game.
The other thing is, like, you know, you're paying for Xbox Gold just to be able to play multiplayer games that you buy on a disc.
Right.
Are you now going to also have to, I would presume that whatever system EA is going to put in place, you can join that for free because they're going to be getting your money for the games.
The silver, yeah.
But you're still going to have to be paying your Xbox Gold in order to play those games.
Multiplayer. Right.
So then again, maybe that system is going to break because you'll be going through their system.
Possibly.
Because Steam is free to join, but you pay for the games.
Right.
And it's going to be an interesting changing world. You know, I know I was talking with a friend who worked for, I think it was GameStop at the time, mm-hmm. and he was sitting there going, I'm seeing the writing on the wall as the manager of the store that things are going to go digital. I don't know how long this company is going to be in business. The other reason, one of the big
reasons.
They're
doing all they can to stay in business.
I know in the UK they just said things that you buy digitally, you can resell. Now, whether that's going to affect people over here in the US as to, right of first sale law is still to be determined.
Yeah.
But I know the game companies are looking at it because it's a lot harder to do that sale of a digital property.
Yeah, definitely.
Or, actually the other half of that is they could then use their digital property to facilitate that. They have their own auction house. So mm-hmm. if I'm done playing a game, I can pop it up into the auction house. Somebody can buy my license. I make some money. They take 10%.
Right.
They're happy because they got a cut of the money.
Yeah.
And it's going to help.
They get another bite at the apple.
That's probably one of the bigger reasons why I see EA going all digital, is it cuts down on the piracy.
Yeah, well, in a session, speaking of piracy, the other big thing with this is that by them going all digital, by mandating all PC stuff goes through their Origin service, they now have, which they did with Dragon Age 2, both on consoles and on PC, you have to have the always connected DRM.
Yeah.
Which people have bemoaned this for the longest time, but this is another case, I think, of writing on the wall, that you're going to have to be constantly connected to play even a single-player game. I don't like it. I think it sucks. If I'm playing a single-player game, I shouldn't have to be online.
They should at least give you a window of disconnect time so that should the power...
If there's a drop or something,
Should something occur where you just lose your signal and it comes back, you don't completely lose your game, which I know people have complained about happening.
Yes.
So at least give us a window to continue playing, pop up a thing saying, you know, network has dropped and
disconnect,
and,
you know, and a game timer. Will shut off and whatever. Save your shit.
Yeah. Give you a chance to, you know, or freeze the game, say, yep, game is saved. It's lost internet connection. So you know what's going on. So you don't just go, great. Now I'm disconnected. What happened? I lost my game.
Right.
All right. Enough of the video game stuff. We're going to go back.
I like talking video game stuff.
I know you do. And if we find some more video game news, we can talk about it. But till then, we've got a big story coming out of Marvel. Marvel's relaunching their lineup.
The Marvel New 52. Oh, wait, no, sorry, hang on. Yes. Marvel Now 52.
Yeah. Axel Alonso, the Marvel editor-in-chief, has said, this ain't no reboot. It's a new beginning.
I think somebody needs to get him a dictionary.
Well, it's interesting because they're not doing what DC did, which is full stop on everything, everything back to one, and go. They're doing this over between October and February.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be ending runs of their current titles and relaunching them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going as relaunching them from number one, as well as introducing new titles as number ones.
Okay.
Marvel's been very happy to renumber their books all the time.
Yeah, again.
Fantastic.
And they call this a new beginning? I would say this is a done before beginning.
Yeah. It's not, and it's, unlike DC, it's not all at once. At least DC gave us the courtesy of all stop and go. This is a brand new start. Now,
which is, it's almost like a rolling restart, which works in NASCAR. I don't know if it works in comics.
Well, the interesting thing is they're not completely revamping the entire Marvel universe either. With this, they're taking the current events of the Marvel universe and they're saying, okay, AVX has ended. It's done. Issue number one. What happens after this?
Right.
They're using,
which they put out some of the previews for that stuff already, but
yeah. So they're using, you know, springboards of events that are going on. They've announced some of the titles, Uncanny Avengers,
mm-hmm.
which, something that's going to delve into both sides of the Avengers X-Men fight.
Which I think is kind of sounds like this is the AVX storyline continued.
Well, it's the, how did this affect the people that were involved?
Right.
How do they carry on afterwards? It's the bridge from the old world to whatever the new, status quo of the Marvel Universe is going to be.
So, the Marvel Universe is actually going to change?
Well, that's changed in the past. And actually, one of the things that's going to highlight that is the all-new X-Men book, which is coming out. Actually, a lot of people are excited because Bendis will be writing the X-Men. But he's not just writing the X-Men. He's writing the original X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
They're bringing back Jean Grey. It's going to be Storm. They're jumping them in the future. So they're actually going to appear in the current Marvel 616 timeline, the standard Marvel Prime Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be looking at themselves and going, what the hell did we turn into? And so it's going
to
be...
It's basically like any little kid going to the future and going, wow, I got fat. What the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Scott became a dick. Wait, he always was. Never mind.
Yeah, I know. That's not news.
So that's going to be an interesting change to see the current timeline with the original Avengers or original X-Men in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they've said Marvel Girl will be returning. She's in the old costume. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out because eventually don't they have to go back in time so that
I think they called it
grow
like,
up.
It's almost like kind of Pleasantville in a way.
At some point they always have to, that series is going to have to end and they go back to where they, to their proper timeline so that they could grow up to become who they are now. So.
But how will that alter the current timeline?
It's all screwed up anyways. And then, they're going to be relaunching Avengers, which Hickman is going to be writing. And with that, it's not just five or six Avengers. It's going to be 18 or more. It's going to be them taking on universe, threatening things. It's not just Earth. They're expanding them out.
It's a combination of it. They'll have the individual single stories focusing on the individual characters as well as the, multi-arc.
They'll be doing one-shots. They'll be doing multi-arcs. They'll be trying to update them for the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, they're planning on making this a huge team book, not just five or six characters. They're trying to make it big and huge.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
I will say, out of
these... It's not as clean as the DC relaunches.
Definitely not. out of these, the Avengers book is the one that really kind of intrigues me more than any of the others, because the Avengers over time, I mean, shit, who hasn't been an Avenger at some point in time? You could probably count the characters on a hand.
Yeah, I think Scott wasn't an Avenger, and Hope wasn't an Avenger.
Right. Well, fix that shit now, didn't they?
Yeah, she's now with, well, she's now with them, but not necessarily a member.
I was going to say Moon Knight, and I remember he just recently became part of the Secret Avengers, briefly. But that was more because everybody looked at him and they're like, no, don't join my team.
Emma Frost? Colossus? I think we're dealing with some of the Avengers
universe versus, cut out the X-books entirely and look at the rest of the Marvel universe.
Spider-Man's an Avenger. Actually, yep. Spider-Man, they got a promo out now, Last Avenger Standing, and it's showing Spider-Man,
yeah.
Yeah.
But out of that main universe, I mean, you're looking through going, yeah, all you bastards. All of you have been Avengers. Even the majority of the Fantastic Four at one point or another.
Thing is showing up in the books right now.
Thing is, Johnny was, I think, for a while. Reed, not really. Reed's just always kind of doing Reed's thing.
Reed's been the Illuminati. He was part of the Illuminati with Iron Man and Mr. and Doctor Strange.
But anyways, the fact that everybody's been an Avenger, it makes sense that the Avengers should be, like, the universe book. Like, this is the one that everybody's involved in because, at some point, everybody has been involved in it.
Yeah. So, but it's, I think they're also talking about defending the entire universe, not just as, like, these characters, but the galaxy and expanding out beyond the borders of Earth and defending it, Silver Surfer type territory. Which they've done some in the past. Yeah, stuff like Secret Wars, where they've brought
the Avengers. I was going to say, the cosmic arena is one that the Marvel Universe has always been a bit iffy with.
They've had their big
things going on in space, but there's never been a very devoted cosmic.
They've had the Infinity War, Infinity Gauntlet. They've had a couple of other, characters that show up now and then. Guardians of the Galaxy, which actually
Nova
this,
and those guys.
Which this makes a lot of sense because there's talk that Guardians of the Galaxy is going to be their 2014 big movie. And Bendis has been wanting to bring back Rocket Raccoon. He's in the promo pictures for this. Certainly Marvel's got a chance to be launching in with the Guardians of the Galaxy and both as the comic books and leading into the movies. So. All right, that's the big story, for this week.
Marvel now. one thing I do want to mention quick, just as an interesting side thing.
No. All right, fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I knew the puppy dog eyes would work. earlier this week, I talked with a buddy of ours who had been on the show previously, Kevin Spooner, and he was mentioning that he was reading and I'm trying to think of exactly what it was. The Unlimited, I think, which is the digital distribution of Marvel Comics.
Right.
And he had told me he was very, very impressed with these runs and how they are very suited for the digital format. They're very suited for the digital reader formats.
Yes.
And that they include in a lot of extra stuff. Some of the things that we had talked about before of what,
wanting to see in a digital format.
Yeah, of like what the AR should have been, but sucked out loud at. Yeah. These are actually kind of doing right.
So it
was interesting to get that review from him that he was really enjoying it. I think he said he was going back and he was reading Fear Itself in that format and getting a lot of good stuff out of it. So it's something worth looking into if either of us had a digital reader.
Well, my problem is the right now the digital tablet of choice for me is the Galaxy Nexus 7 from Google Nexus 7, which is their new 7-inch that's about to be released.
Right.
If it's not that, I would be looking at the Nook tablet.
Yeah. Which the Nooks I like. I think those look really, really nice.
And both are Android, but they're 7 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems, for me, too small for reading. Maybe it's because I'm not looking at something optimized for digital, and I'm used to reading on that full, 8.5 by 11 comic book page.
Have you played with anything that has, like, a retina display on it to really see what the resolution can be?
I'm tempted to stop by the Apple store to look at the iPad with the retina display, because that's the only thing that has that resolution.
Right.
But even that screen is smaller than your standard comics page. And not only that, but you're never going to be able to see a two-page spread the way it's intended to on one of those things.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you, you turn to a two-page spread, it turns at 90 degrees, you gotta flip it and look at it, and now you've got everything at half size. Right. Even with the resolution that you can get on there, it's still small. And that's really what it comes down to, is it's small. Yeah, if I could find something that had that full comic book size screen that was double wide,
mm-hmm.
if I could read on that, which would be massive, so it'd have to be foldable to be portable.
Yeah, which that technology just isn't quite here yet.
No.
They've got some things that are close.
They've got foldable, you know, OLED screens that can roll up. Something like that, it's a 11-inch wide stick that you could pull out a screen on.
But seeing something like that coming into a portable media type device.
And it's going to cost insane.
Yeah, it's way outside of our current tech.
There's nothing out there that makes
Iron
me
Man would have it.
Looking, that makes me want to look at a comic book. The closest thing I could think of would be using a Pico projector to project the image on the back of, on the table or on the back of a seat in front of me on a wall. Where I can sit there and use the Pico projector to get it the size that I want to read.
Because
for me, zooming in and out, I know you can do that, and that's what a lot of people do. I like being able to look at that full page and take it all in as one thing.
Yeah.
That's part of the joy of a comic book, because looking at a whole page and seeing how the whole thing fits together.
Yeah. With me reading fan translations of manga for so long online, I'm less averse to it, but that's just out of experience, I think, more than anything else. Yeah. I should mention, I am very proud of myself for getting through that entire thing and not just completely ripping into you for talking about how 7 inches isn't enough for you and how you don't want to look at anything smaller than 7 inches. And, I almost
what can
got
I say? I like it big. It's all about the size. I don't care what they tell you.
Size matters.
If she says it's a good size.
She's lying.
Right. That's just the kind way of saying it's small.
Oh, God. I have a great misogynistic joke, and I can't tell it because it wouldn't work over audio.
Well, then. Let's go ahead and get
out
of this.
That seems like a good place to stop.
Yeah, we're starting to get slap happy.
Yeah. Alrighty.
So, if you want to get a hold of us, all of our information is available at about.me/comicbooktesseract. We have a Facebook page, Comic Book Tesseract. For Google Plus, we are gplus.to/comicbooktesseract. You can catch our website and comic review articles from other people as well as us at thecomicbooknerd.com.
Oh, and I should jump in and say that, I think we mentioned it last week. We're still working on getting, distributed through heroeshavencomics.com as well.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Heroes Haven, love it. It's a great shop if you're in the Tampa area. Mm-hmm. Stop by, visit them. They're great guys.
Absolutely. Okay.
Back to where we were. Follow Justin on Twitter, Felix T. Cat. That's with a K and two T's.
Just like Cat Williams. Yes.
But much older.
Much older and not as short.
And then I am Jay Polieff. You can email us, comicbooktesseract@gmail.com. Send us a text message or leave us a voicemail at 50Tesseract. That's 508-377-3722. Again, all of this information is available at about.me/comicbooktesseract. For Justin Chalupka, I'm Jason Polieff, and we'll see you next time when we step inside the Tesseract.